I'm ready. Okay, so as Miss Christie sits down and reads all of that stuff, prior to me starting the meeting, you betcha. Okay, I'll call this meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission to order on Thursday, November 10th, 2005. Could we have a roll call, please?
Commissioner Gibson?
Here.
Commissioner Rappa?
Here.
Commissioner Melskow?
Here.
Commissioner Christie?
Here.
Chairman Rose?
Here. I'd ask that we all please stand for a flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, now's the time in our meeting where we take public comment on issues that are not on our agenda. Our agenda on the tan paper is back on that wooden box on the left as you're going out. And there are speaker slips. I seem to have some already. If you would be so kind as, if you wish to address the commission, fill one out and I'll call your name in order and spell it right. I don't have any for public comment. I don't see anybody coming forward. Therefore, I'll close public comment on general things, and we'll obviously have public comment on each item as it's taken. Moving on to planning staff update. The first question I have 2 weeks from now is Thanksgiving. Mr. Hogue, you're not going to make us come in on Thanksgiving, are you? We had some plan. Could you refresh us what it was?
You're more than welcome to come in on Thanksgiving, but you're going to be awful lonely. No. And you might have found the building locked. No, what we've decided to do, the regular second meeting of the month does fall on Thanksgiving Day, and we've instead rescheduled the meeting for November 30th, which is a Wednesday, in this room at the normal starting time. So the listening and watching public should be advised that that will be a Planning Commission meeting on a Wednesday, and it will be, in essence, the fifth Wednesday of the month.
So that's almost 3 weeks from now.
Correct.
Okay. Thanks.
And if I might, Mr. Chair, I'll continue on with planning staff updates. I'm Warren Hogue, Department of Planning and Building. The first thing I wanted a few weeks while their space is being remodeled, where they are now in room, I don't know the name of the room, but it's next to room 300. And actually, part of the environmental division will be in room 300. So just to keep you abreast of those changes. Also, I think we're very close to nailing down a date for the Planning Commission retreat in late January. It'll probably be a Friday. And I don't have the date at my fingertips, but I think it's going to be probably the fourth Friday, but we have to get a confirmation on the room, so I'll report back to you on November 30th, but I wanted you to circle that date. I don't have a calendar for 2006 right at my fingertips, so I can't give you the date. And I guess Ramona doesn't either, because I'm looking. But that's okay. We'll get back to you. And let's see. I think that's pretty much it for planning staff updates, and there's no public comment to respond to, so I think we can just get on with the rest of the day, unless your commission has any questions you'd like to ask staff at this point. Oh, Matt, I'm sorry. Did you have any staff updates from the coastal zone? Okay.
Commission questions?
Mr. Chairman, you mentioned our next meeting is almost 2 weeks from now. It's almost 3 weeks, one day short of 3 weeks.
Okay.
Right?
I thought that's what I said, but...
No, you said two, it should be three.
Listen to what I mean, not what I say.
Okay.
I have a very short announcement I'd like to make.
All right.
Get a mute button.
The red. No, but you want it to be off. And you want the green on.
It's been so long since I've been here. I just wanted to let the commissioners and the public know that on Wednesday, November 30th, unfortunately that's a commission meeting day for us, the Coastal Commission is going to be conducting a public workshop on ag land preservation that focuses primarily on the drafting and enforcement of agricultural easements. And the Coastal Commission has put a lot of effort into this. We've gathered a great team of experts to participate in the conversation. And if anybody is interested in attending, I'm just going to pass these out to folks here on the commission. But if anyone else is interested, I think the extras will probably pile up over there with Mr. Hogue.
This is the one you emailed me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Need to save it then. Okay. Anyone else?
Passover.
Seeing none, moving on to the consent agenda. Any need to be pulled there? Comment?
I wonder if we might have just a little clarification on items D and E, which are slightly unusual ag preserve items.
Is that D as in dog? Or?
D like, yes, D delta and E echo.
Oh, all right. Delta echo. I see our ag preserve expert up here at the podium.
I just couldn't quite tease from the staff report exactly why we end up with this more complicated than usual system of contracts on what appears to be one parcel or two parcels. I could
be happy to try to explain it. Terry Waller, planning staff, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. This one is a little bit unusual. It is actually, I guess the complexity begins when a lot line adjustment occurred and the band through the center of your exhibit on D6 of your packet represents the area that was transferred through a lot line adjustment to resolve a boundary dispute.
So those are two separate parcels that we're looking at. It looks like
the north and the south parcels are actually the separate existing parcels.
Okay, under separate ownership?
Right. The band that you see through the center is not a legal parcel. However, it's an area that is part of the legal description of the original contract to the south, and it got transferred through the lot line adjustment to the northern property owner. And that, as you will recognize, is a violation of the Williamson Act. So this part of this proposal, or the main thrust, is to correct this discrepancy.
Okay.
And the reason we found out about it was an application for a parcel map came in for the northern property, and we indicated that they had to remedy the violation before we could proceed with processing of the parcel map. So they agreed. There's a number of different possibilities, but the one that they agreed to do was to go ahead and put the northern property in the Williamson Act by rescinding the existing fractional portion of the contract and then ending up with two separate contracts for each resulting parcel. So it is a little bit unusual in that respect. However, it does correct the violation, and it can stand alone whether or not the parcel map is approved. So it's independent of that. This action is actually independent of that. We have spoken with council about the ability to do separate contracts on a single parcel transition between when Frank Heinzman was doing the program and I took over the program. It's possible there was just miscommunication. It could have been new staff people. We had some new staff people that came and have since left. And it's possible that they were unaware of the importance of checking the Williamson Act contract status. I think actually that was the reason.
Do we have do we have a database where Williamson Act contracts get entered into,
yes,
linked
to
specific APN numbers?
It's actually fairly easy to check and see if it's under contract by looking in exactly that, a database on the computer.
So it would have been a question of they didn't check?
I presume so, but again, I don't know for sure why that was missed. But it was several years ago.
Okay. I forgive my denseness. It might be the early hour, but the entire shaded area that we see on D6, which apparently is two separate parcels in two separate ownerships, is that true?
Well, there's D6 and then there's E6.
Okay.
And there's a contract being proposed for each one. So basically we're expanding the preserve area. That's the action before you. It's expanding the preserve area for each one, and there will be a follow-up contract upon approval by the Board of Supervisors.
So the entirety of the northern parcel is going to end up under Williamson Act?
Correct.
And it is the subject of a potential parcel map application?
Exactly, in addition to this action.
But given the minimum parcel size, there's no subdivision that's going to occur there until that contract runs out. That's what's confusing me a little bit.
Well, actually, in terms of the acreages, the northern, more heavily shaded area
mm-hmm.
is 80 acres, in excess of 80 acres. It's under vineyard, and so it should qualify for the two parcels.
Okay.
So it's likely that the parcel map will meet the minimum requirements of the subdivision aspect of the proposal.
Okay, and the more lightly shaded parcel, COAL 97054, is under contract or not?
It's already under contract.
It's not really subject to this action.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
The map on the screen shows a little bit better than our
I wanted to mention that, unfortunately, our report graphics didn't really copy very well, and that item D is the left-hand side of the dark portion of the northern half, and item E is contract number 2, the right-hand side.
Okay, and that corresponds to the proposed parcel map that's
correct.
Going in. Okay.
And both of those parcels individually qualify because they have more than 20 acres of irrigated
right.
vineyards.
Okay.
Okay, we cleared up D and E?
Yes.
Any other?
Mr. Chairman, I have a quick question on item B as in boy, page B1. I've talked to Mr. Waller about this already, which says minimum term of contract 20 years. Well, I saw that, then I looked real quick to see if it's a security zone, and it was not. So to me, the minimum contract means what does it work down to, which is 10 years. So I was confused when I saw that 20 years there.
Actually, it's a brand new contract, and so it would be the initial term is 20 years. It would continue each year going down to 10, and once it's at 10, it'll roll over at 10. I had explained that earlier. And it's been our practice to say minimum, use the phrase minimum term of contract. It's possible we could entertain different wording if it's confusing.
I would.
I want to also point out that 20-year terms are not limited exclusively to farmland security zones. Mm-hmm. They're also for regular ag preserve contracts when they're not adjacent to a village reserve line or more than 1 mile from an urban reserve line. But you're right. The 20 years is the initial term, and then when it gets down to 10, that's when it starts extending 10 years into the future.
Okay, so that raises another question then. Is this actually a minimum of 20, or does it work down to 10, this one?
It's a minimum of 20 because the reference is to the initial term of the contract.
But it does work down to 10?
Eventually, yes, after 10 years.
Because you look at some of these other ones here, and you have 10 years.
That's so because they're either amendments to existing contracts, and the law says that you give them the remaining term of contract but not less than 10 years, or they're new contracts that are within 1 mile of an urban reserve line.
See, so that's confusing. At least I think it is.
It's maybe Mr. Waller could work up some new words here.
Yeah.
I think he's got direction on that.
I would say that just initial term of contract is the right terminology when we have a 20 there. And the complexities of the Williamson Act is why we have a planner dedicated to it. Having sat on the Ag Preserve Review Committee, it's not simple to administer.
And he's slowly losing his hair.
Yeah.
Any other questions on the consent agenda? Entertain motions, then?
We need to go to the public?
Oh, yes, we should. Any one from the public wishes to?
We've been through the plan and the EIR and have a couple of loose ends to tie up. It's been a fairly long process, but we're about 99% finished with the Planning Commission review of it, and want to take this opportunity to thank everybody who's come to the meetings and has given their input on the public hearing draft. We've made some significant changes and significant strides in making the plan that I think everyone can support. Although John Ufrat is on vacation and not able to be here today, we have the rest of the project team available, including our consultant, David Early, to answer any remaining questions that you may have. Your commission completed its review of the public hearing draft, and packets with replacement pages showing the changes recommended by your commission were distributed prior to your last meeting. And at your last meeting, your commission did make one additional change to the packet, and that was to change the percentage of visitor-serving water that may be used for the affordable housing from a maximum of 5% to a maximum of 25%. And that change has been made, and a replacement page has been distributed this morning. Also, at your last meeting, your commission discussed the environmental impact report. and much of the discussion was regarding the Planning Commission changes and how by virtue of those changes, the plan has really changed into a Planning Commission recommended draft, which is somewhere between the public hearing draft that we began this process with and the decreased development alternative, and that this Planning Commission recommended draft is considered the environmentally superior alternative because it would result in a smaller population, placing less demand on the water and water supply and traffic circulation system. And staff has revised the CEQA findings to reflect the Commission's direction, and those findings have been distributed. We've received a comment letter from the Coastal Commission late yesterday, and we've reviewed these comments, and many of them reflect some of the changes that your commission has already made to the planning, to the public hearing draft, and others I think will take some discussion between commission staff and county staff on figuring out how to address those. Some of them I believe are already addressed. Some of them may be on maybe resolved through some communication and understanding. We have not spoken with the commission staff about any of the comments yet, and what staff recommends is that your commission accept the comments into the record for consideration by the Board of Supervisors, and that allows staff the time, the minimum 60-day review period between the Planning Commission hearings and the time the Board considers the Planning Commission recommended draft for staff and county staff and commission staff to work through these comments. In conclusion, your commission should consider whether the replacement pages accurately reflect all of the commission's tentative recommendations, make any modifications as it sees fit. The commission should then make final recommendations to the Board of Supervisors on the Cambrian San Simeon Acres Community Plans of the North Coast Area Plan and Environmental Impact Report. This concludes staff's comments, and I am available for questions.
First thing on these comments from the Coastal Commission that you intend to forward to the Board of Supervisors, I presume that'll be part of their packet, and you'll have some analysis of those, and the public will have the opportunity to weigh in.
Correct.
Thank you. Questions for staff?
I'd like to say that while I missed the last meeting, I did review the DVD, and I'd like to thank my colleagues on the commission for taking the time to clarify the issues, particularly regarding the affordable housing water allotment. One thing that was brought out in that discussion was that the 5% allocation, regardless of how we define it, 5% of what, I think it was Mr. McNulty who pointed out that that's the ceiling, not the floor, and that the CSD could allocate as little as 1% or no percent of that water to affordable housing, and it was really up to them. And I didn't catch that nuance when we were talking about that language, and I'm wondering if maybe we want to change the language there to establish both a ceiling and a floor to ensure that affordable housing does occur as I think we all collectively envisioned it when we discussed that section.
Well, I see there's members from the Services District here. I'll bet they can give us their opinion on that.
I'm interested to know. Yeah, I mean, sure. But, I mean, I'm interested in what we all think as well, because that was news to me, and I wonder if it was news to anyone else, because it kind of was.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a quick comment. if you put a minimum and there isn't the customers to use that, how are they going to enforce it? I mean, it's
given place at any given time. We are allowing the provision for it to be encouraged. And so demanding that a certain fraction be allocated to a particular use that doesn't follow through elsewhere in the plan, I mean, I like the idea. Yes, I'd like to encourage it, but it would seem to me consistency would be that if the language is changed there, then we encourage the maximum use of the set-aside allotment, because we're in a balancing situation. Another worthy goal, according to the Coastal Act, is the provision of visitor-serving capability. So, you know, we're in this balancing act, and we haven't in the rest of the plan set down that there shall be this much affordable housing relative to this much visitor-serving. So I would be all for encouraging the maximal use of that set aside as provision for affordable housing. I think that's consistent with the goals and policies elsewhere in the plan.
Well, the problem is when you just encourage something in a planning document, it doesn't necessarily make anything happen.
Right.
But
that's what we've done elsewhere in the plan. We haven't demanded affordable housing anywhere else. We've only encouraged affordable housing everywhere else.
I would just suggest that this is a way to make that encouragement more likely to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sensing I have the concurrence.
I'm not weighing in until I hear from the public on it. Ms. Rappa, did you?
No, I'll wait.
Okay. Well, I had just a couple more comments relative to the DVD. And do you want to take comments on that question first?
No, I would just assume we get all our questions for staff out there.
Okay.
And then we'll hear from the public, okay. And then we'll move on them.
There was also the question about the recommendation we're going to make to the Board of Supervisors about stopping the stockpiling process of the building allocations. And that actually tracks one of the suggestions that is in the Coastal Commission letter. And I think we're all on agreement on how to handle that. But in the discussion at the last hearing, I think, again, it was Mr. McNulty who said, well, you know, if we do that, we'll have to amend the growth management ordinance, and that will take a certain amount of time. And, you know, there's still going to be allocations that will be piling up during that period of time. But I have to question why, if the growth management ordinance has not been certified in the coastal zone, also as pointed out by the Coastal Commission letter, why we would have to, if we didn't have to amend the LCP in order to implement the growth management ordinance as we've been doing, why would we have to amend the growth management ordinance to change how we're implementing it in the coastal zone?
Sounds like a question for Mr. McNulty.
I'm Tim McNulty, and I'm trying to remember exactly the conversation that we had a couple weeks ago on that topic. I think the concern that I had was, if I'm remembering right, the language that was proposed was going to attempt to tie the growth management ordinance to the plan that we're working on by prescribing a growth rate or a growth number of some kind, which would obviously be potentially in conflict with the county's growth management ordinance unless they were made to be amended at the same time. Do you remember the exact the page maybe that so we could go to the language that we're talking about?
Oh, I watched the discussion on the DVD.
Okay.
So
apparently liked it.
Yeah, I see a big smiley on there. Come on, let's show what we did here.
There's
big smiley here.
That
for
was
us?
Courtesy of the good folks at AGP Video, and thanks
okay.
for sending that along. The discussion that I as I interpreted it was this commission has unanimously come to the conclusion that the stockpiling of those water allocations should not continue, and we
right.
wanted the county to stop doing that, you know, today ASAP right away, and so. We were going to forward them a letter with that recommendation that they would be hearing, I think county staff had said they're going to review the growth management ordinance in March, but they're going to be doing something similar in December, I think.
The RMS.
The RMS.
Yeah. So I'm with you for all of that. That was,
right.
That's all fine.
Right.
No problems with any
but
of that.
Then, and maybe I misunderstood, but then I understood county council's position was, well, they can review the letter in December, but then what they would have to do is amend the growth ordinance accordingly, and that's going to take a period of time, and that, you know, the allocations will continue to stockpile while we amend our growth management ordinance to reflect the commission's suggestions.
Well, that's a different issue than the one I thought we were talking about. The Planning Commission at any time can voice its view about what the growth management ordinance
right.
should be or shouldn't be. And the Board of Supervisors at any time that there are enough votes to do so can elect to amend the growth.
I'm under the strong hunch that it was direction to staff or just staff's interpretation of the ordinance. Because if it was an amendment to the growth management ordinance, it's not a legitimate amendment to the growth management ordinance because it's not in the LCP, which governs
Well, there we disagree, of course. I mean, the county's view since the inception of the Growth Management Ordinance is that it's not a component of the LCP and hasn't ever been, and can be amended without regard to whether or not the Coastal Commission agrees or disagrees with the changes that are made to it. And there's, of course, provisions in the Coastal Act for local government regulation that exceeds the breadth of that covered by the LCP, and that's what we're operating under when we do that. So there's nothing, it's not a zoning ordinance, so it's not part of the local coastal program. But I don't think that the board is hindered in any way by the LCP. If it wanted to carry out the direction that your commission wants to give to them on that point, they would certainly be able to do that.
And I'm not suggesting we amend the LCP. I'm just trying to get those allocations, stockpiling allocations, stopped.
That wouldn't require an amendment to the LCP.
But would it require an amendment to the Growth Management Ordinance?
I don't know. It, like I said the last time, I think it depends on... I remember when the board directed the staff to do that, and I don't know whether that was a result of actual amendment language that was incorporated into the Growth Management Ordinance, or that was simply, staff, this is how we want you to interpret the Growth Management Ordinance.
Okay.
And that, you know, we could resolve that pretty quickly.
Yeah, it seems like that's pretty critical research that would need to be done before we could really send them an informed... recommendation on the matter.
But we're sending the letter.
Carry it out and however they need to do it. So.
Yeah. Ms. Sneeder could talk about the timing of the letter and where it's going.
Right, and Ramona, if you can bring it up on the screen. One of the changes to the memo that I drafted up that the commission made was to add that the Planning Commission requests that this issue be addressed as soon as possible in order to correct the situation. So what that includes is could include now looking at this question of whether it actually needs an amendment to the Title 26 or if it's just a change in interpretation. But I think that change that your commission made at the last hearing would inform the board that you wish it happens as soon as possible.
And then lastly, there was quite a bit of discussion about the decreased decreased build-out alternative versus the recommended alternative, and how we can certify the EIR when it makes findings that we don't necessarily agree with, and that is that the two alternatives essentially have the same environmental impact, even though one of them, you know, I think clearly will have more impacts because there'll be is it 375 or 325?
325 extra.
325 additional units. And so that, I just didn't really follow that to my satisfaction. How, if we want to recommend the decreased build-out alternative as the environmentally superior alternative and therefore preferred for the board, how can we certify an EIR that makes findings that are contrary to that?
And at the last Planning Commission meeting, the Commission directed staff to revise those findings, and those have been distributed. And just to summarize, what came as a conclusion of all the discussion was that by virtue of all the Planning Commission's recommended changes, this public hearing draft has really changed into a new kind of project, the Planning Commission recommended draft. And that is in between this, what we started with as the public hearing draft and the decreased development alternative. And this Planning Commission recommended draft is the environmentally superior alternative in that it would result in a smaller population and decrease the impacts to water supply and traffic. And that's reflected in the revised findings that were distributed to you and described in this paragraph shown here on the screen.
Mr. Hawley brought up a point that the 1.6 people per household assumption didn't necessarily track with his personal experience of Cambria. He thought it was more like 2.3 people per household. Did staff have any response to that concern?
If you look in the EIR, the analysis of the population is always done on a range, a high and low range, to capture the differences. And I think John Hofshore has some information on population trends. I believe it changes between summer and winter occupancy.
For second homes.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks for that clarification.
All right.
Further questions?
Yes. Ms. Niederon, you gave us Chapter 7, Findings of Fact, and Statement of Overriding Considerations. And I'm looking at the section on page 14 of that memo, which talks about significant impacts which cannot be avoided in number 4. And I just wanted to make sure I understood how the water supply in Cambria, given the changes that we've made to the plan at this point, ends up to be a significant and unavoidable impact. So if you go over to page 15, it notes a significant and unavoidable impact, water-1. Build-out projections for the community plans update would lead to an increase in water demand in Cambria up to approximately 1,685 acre-feet per year and would be on the current permitted groundwater supply of 1,230 acre-feet per year available to the CSD. And that's, yes, that's right. But in the plan, we do recognize that we have the provision in there that no construction permit's going to be let until an intent to serve letter comes from the CCSD, and no intent to serve letters are going to come from the CCSD until supplemental water is available in the form of the desalination plant. And so I guess the question is, the one thing that I read is that the question of providing that supplemental water does rest with an agency that's beyond the control of the county. Is that why we end up with this showing as a significant and unavoidable impact?
Yes, because in order to provide the water for, they're in a moratorium right now. So in order to provide water to any additional units, they would have to secure an additional water supply. And you're correct, that would be under the purview of the CCSD.
Okay. Because it seems obvious that we've done everything we can.
Correct.
To mitigate excessive use of the resource there, and I was a little surprised to see it pop up as...
You're correct.
Okay.
Further questions for staff? And then I'll move on to the...
One other. And back on the... In discussing the alternatives, back on page... rejection of alternatives starts on page 17, and you go through the existing plan alternative, the increased development alternative. On the last page, 19, alternative C, decreased development plan alternative, and it's finding that while the decreased development plan alternative achieves project's goals, it is not an environmentally superior alternative. And I was just, it would just occur to me that since we've made reference to the fact that the Planning Commission, I guess all I was looking for in there was some reference to the fact that if this goes into the final EIR, that the Planning Commission recommended draft amounts to plus or minus that alternative C, and it is. I guess it's a bit of a technicality to reject alternative C as not environmentally superior when it's so close to the one that we have identified as such.
Are you looking for language maybe here that mirrors what was in the project history discussion that talked about the Planning Commission recommended draft being close to this?
I guess let me just say in general, it seemed to me there needed to be a clearer statement somewhere that the Planning Commission recommended draft was the environmentally superior alternative and in most of its impacts was essentially that of the decreased development alternative. And I'm not... However, that could be made clear to the Board of Supervisors and the Coastal Commission, I think, is the important goal here.
Okay.
So you're suggesting adding another sentence or two to the finding?
If that, I mean, it's not something I don't feel it's necessary for us to wordsmith it, but I just wanted to get that idea to Martha. That might be one of the solutions, yes.
Well, I guess I would I would absolutely agree, and I'm sorry, but I found all these 21 pages a little bit confusing, and I would have preferred that somehow it stated it right up front that, you know, by revisions to the draft document, we did conclude that the superior, alternative was the best. And somehow it just gets lost in here, and I don't know, maybe it's a requirement of law or something, but it certainly well, it certainly seems there would be a much more straightforward way to do this.
I think
red or something like that.
Well, no, I mean, if it's part of the staff report that goes to the board, you know, really the rubber meeting the road business is the findings of the fact.
What I can do is just simply add, you know, another page in here right in the beginning where it just simply summarizes that, and that's the only thing on the page to make it clear and upfront.
I think that would be helpful.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think it definitely needs to become part of the record, not just part of the materials that go on to the board.
Right.
Okay, I think we got agreement on that. And I see another gentleman has stepped to the front here. Don't whisper. You got to talk to us.
Author of the EIR, and I just wanted maybe to consult with Martha for a moment. Is that okay?
Okay. Well, we'll move on to the public comment while you're whispering here in front of us here. Unless there's other questions? Seeing none, I'll move it on to the public comment. I have several speaker slips, and if Bill Allen would come forth and grab a microphone, and Wayne Ryburn, if he'd be so kind as to take the other one. And we'll keep going and alternating that way. Thank you. Bill?
Good morning. I'm Bill Allen from Cambria. And 2 weeks ago, I gave you a little of my background in community activity so you know why I've been involved in this. And the only document I have in front of me this morning is your Chapter 7 findings. And I haven't obviously had a chance to look through the whole thing, but my comment has to do with those that have been advanced here already by a couple of your commissioners, and that is that the item, the alternative C, decreased development plan alternative, what I see written down here now seems to be in complete contradiction to what I heard at this meeting 2 weeks ago. Now, this may just be a matter of semantics. Maybe you're not saying what you really mean to say. It certainly is not what I thought I heard 2 weeks ago, and therefore I urge you to change this language to reflect what I think was meant to be said in here, to reflect what was told to you and what I thought you told to us 2 weeks ago. Thank you.
Thank you. Wayne Ryburn, followed by John McGarry.
Good morning. My name is Wayne Ryburn. I'm a resident of Cambria. I'm here representing the North Coast Alliance. I have a letter for you. It's very brief. I will not read it, but it's for the record. And as you can see, it tries to clarify what you've been talking about before with a decreased development alternative. And I am reading from page 19, chapter 7, of your findings that was handed out this morning, and I too am very confused about this. It reads, while a decreased plan alternative achieves the project goals, it is not environmentally superior alternative. I think that flies in the face of what you've been talking about. There is a difference. It is superior. CEQA requires that you make a declaration on the superior one, and we hope that you would do that and have it as part of the finding, not just an appendix or a letter floating around someplace that could get lost. So we thank you for considering that. We thank your support. Reinforcing the service district that we're supporting, they've spent over $100,000 on this to try to get their build-out reduction program well-defined and and in a manner that can be really implemented. And it kind of flies in the face of reality to approve a plan other than that would never be implemented for political or other reasons. So we thank you for really scrutinizing this and seeing it for what it is. I had one comment that came up in my mind this morning about population. You were concerned about that. What makes it very difficult in Cambria as far as population and getting a handle on it is vacation rentals. And the Board of Supervisors on Tuesday spent a lot of time talking about this. And I don't see how at any one time you can get a population figure, because those vacation rentals are like motels. They go up and down. They go up significantly, as you pointed out, in the summertime. So if that is a thought that could be implemented in your consideration when you talk about that, it might help a little bit. And thank you very much. We're all glad this is our last meeting. And thanks for the work.
Okay. John McGarry.
Good morning,
followed
ladies.
Followed by Casey Kempner. And that's the last speaker slip I have, so you want to get one in if you want to weigh in here.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John McGarry. And again, it's something that I really I'm very grateful for. Thank you.
Thank you. Casey Kempner?
Yeah, my name is Casey Kempner. I'm from San Luis Obispo. My family owns two pieces of property on McCabe Drive. I sent you guys all a letter via email. Our main concerns are regarding property rights. By limiting the development in Cambria to 4,650 units, you're essentially taking away hundreds of property rights to develop their parcels to the full extent. I'm also concerned with the general plan housing element consistency. You guys have mentioned, or the county staff long-range planning had prepared a concept paper titled Designating Additional Land in Residential Multifamily, Residential and Single-Family Land Use Categories. Basically, that paper said the county is going to be 4,000 units short countywide for their goals of the housing element by 2015. By further reducing these lots in Cambria to only 4,650, you're taking away further lots from that development, thus adding to the 4,000-lot deficiency. That would create a need for additional development elsewhere in the county in less suitable areas for development, not quite as good as Cambria. The last comment that I didn't address in the letter is regarding the Board of Supervisors' smart growth principles. And by reducing the Cambria build-out potential to 4,650, you're going against the Board's smart growth principles. The first principle that we'd be going against is strengthen and direct development towards existing communities. By limiting the development in Cambria, you're going to force development to go outside in the county and other places that aren't so suitable for growth. The other is create a range of housing opportunities and choices. As the action portion of the smart growth principle points out, neighborhoods should be safe, convenient, attractive, and affordable. Low-density development too often forces trade-offs between these goals. If you push development elsewhere, it's not going to be high-density like Cambria. Cambria has lots that are 25-foot wide, 75-foot deep. That's pretty much the highest density you're going to find anywhere in the state. Another smart growth principle was take advantage of compact building design. The action portion of this principle states the county will encourage communities to incorporate more compact building design as an alternative to conventional land consumptive development. The majority of these lots in Cambria, again, are 75 feet deep by 25 to 50 feet wide. Very few communities offer this opportunity to focus density and develop lots. And the fourth is make development decisions predictable, fair, and cost effective. My grandfather purchased this property in the 1970s. It was unpredictable. It would have been unpredictable for him to assume you guys are going to limit the development in Cambria. And it's also taking our legal right to develop the property. The Kempner Family Trust is opposed to taking the limitation of property rights as proposed by CCSD and discussed by the County Planning Commission. We encourage the Commission to return the property rights to the Cambria property owners and focus development on existing legal parcels which are suitable for development. Let my family use the legal right to develop our parcels. In conclusion, we're confident the Planning Commission will address our concerns.
Thank you. I have one more speaker slip here. Dennis Damian Lynch. And was the Services District going to weigh in here? Okay, when you do, jump up to the other microphone. Mr. Lynch.
Good morning. Dennis Damian Lynch.
You can pull that up to you.
Thank you. I currently reside in Morro Bay. 3 minutes would never be enough time to suitably walk you a mile in my shoes. I'm sure I speak for many. Being a landowner in Cambria, my wife and I, prior to the moratorium, prior to limiting growth, prior to many of these decisions that you are speaking to, I'm really, this is a very emotional issue. I'm a native Californian. I've lived in California all my life, 43 years old. I'm a coastal zone Californian. I've seen a lot in this state over the years. When I acquired our land for my family in Cambria, I went through the normal channels. I was introduced to a realtor, went through the escrow process, did some homework, was aware of issues in the town. Now, fast forward. We continue by choice to perform our own weed abatement services. There's been an increased effort by the fire department to increase our responsibilities in that regard. It's not just a fire break. It's in the entire parcels. We own three separate parcels in town. We have been under siege, per se, by some of the treatment by the neighbors. When I say that, I mean just total disregard and disrespect because we're considered speculators, out-of-town landowners, which we're not. The effort we've gone through over the years maintaining our property, being stewards of our land, I'm talking pertinent matter that affects land ownership. In other words, what we go through to perform our weed abatement, to go through the paying the property taxes, to live within this county, to assimilate here, be good citizens, good stewards, be neighborly, be respectful, etc. All of these things which we would naturally want to conduct ourselves in that sort of a fashion, being part of the community. But we feel the community is against us. I must tell you, the bottom line is, This is just wrong, this idea that this growth cap is just going to negate everybody's potential dream. I just want to leave you with this one comment. I don't have any immediate plans to develop our property, but the bottom line here, folks, is what you're sharing, this basic attitude about, well, your land will be mute, it'll become unviable. I think you should be liable for your comments because you're basically trashing the market value of our property as we speak. Who's going to buy a vacant land if there's no, real rights appreciating that land? In other words, who would be interested in a property that's rendered useless? So this is all convenient when they embark on this lot retirement or lot reduction program to basically trash the value of our properties, and then when you come around to decide to potentially buy us out, what's the intrinsic value? What's the market value at that point? I find this just to be astounding, and basically I reject these discussions. I'm sorry. I can't speak clearly because I'm too emotional about this.
Thank you. Bob Greason's.
Thank you. I'm Bob Grestens with Cambria Community Services District. I know you might have some questions for us. There was a question earlier on about the affordable housing, whether it should be a max and minimum. I think our comments were outlined in a September 28th letter. I don't have that letter with me, but we did talk about the affordable housing. I know our board has expressed a 200 maximum as a desired goal in that particular category. I think there's some other potential concerns related to traffic and parking and so forth that goes along with some of those areas. But we do support the 4650 number, the decreased development number. It's pretty much the goal that's been stated by our board of directors in the past. And that there is a build-out reduction plan that's being developed that will become part of our environmental impact report for our water master plan. So at that point, I'll leave it at that. I think there's the Coastal Commission letter is new information to us, and we're reading that right now, trying to understand it. I don't know how much discussion's happened with staff so far between the Coastal Commission. I notice on page 2 under Community Standard 1, they talk about demonstrated that CCSD has adequate implementation measures consistent with Coastal Act policies for priority uses. I'm not quite sure what that means in relation to affordable housing, if they're saying affordable housing is priority use, or if they're saying it's really visitor serving that's an affordable or priority use. So I'm a little confused on that point at the moment, and I suppose we'll have to catch up to that at the Board of Supervisors level if that's what the plan is here. So that's all I really have to say unless you have
a question. Okay, any questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's the last speaker slip I have. Seeing no one coming forward, I'll close the public comment, bring it back to the Commission for Action. Saw like two themes there in our speakers, and I thank him, as I thank everyone who has taken the time to come down or watch some meetings and come down to others and give us their opinion. And I think their process is well served by your time that you've spent here. And we thank you for that. I did hear one concern about the same thing the Commission had, and so we're agreed we're going to add some more substantial language on page 19. Or
actually, if Ramona will bring up the computer screen. A couple of proposed changes. So this would be right after the title page. It'd be simply a page with the Planning Commission recommended draft and the statement that it is considered to be the environmentally superior alternative. So that would be the first thing that people come to. And then also...
And that italicized was your very recent changes. Am I correct?
Or this would be a new page. So it would follow page 2 in what was distributed to you. It would be right before we get to the findings of fact. So that would be a brand new page.
And those only two are the water and...
Well, certainly I'm not suggesting that we delete water or traffic, right. But I think the reduced impacts on the natural environment in Cambria and the ecosystem, the forest, which is much of it is mapped, ESHA, that also contributes to why this is the environmentally superior alternative. Granted, it wasn't included in the need to make overriding concerns. But nevertheless, what the Commission is now recommending does also result in a net improvement or decrease in the impacts to the natural resources in Cambria. And I just I think that's worth noting.
Anyone else want to agree?
I thought our logic was pretty clear. We were just trying. But I do have I must be just not with it or something. Our recommendation is to the Board of Supervisors, and yet it's being suggested that we need to make these findings or overriding considerations. If we're identifying the decreased alternative as the superior project, in my mind, I don't find it necessary to have these overriding considerations, because that's not what we're recommending. And maybe that's why I found this thing so confusing when we received all this, and maybe I just need an explanation.
I think Mr. McDulty can help us there.
Did anyone else have this problem?
Well, no, because I thought in a perfect world, we're going to recommend things, and the board won't change a single word and say we agree, and there goes. So what we're recommending is they adopt this language. We're not adopting it. We're recommending they adopt it. Okay, and we're doing all their hard work for them, and we're making it up for them. And they're going to take it lock, stock, and barrel.
I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. I think the situation is one you might be familiar with in other projects, and that is even though you're adopting what you believe is the environmentally superior alternative, it's nevertheless the case that due to resource constraints in the community, that will result in, over time, the adoption of that plan will result in potentially significant environmental impacts. So therefore, in order to approve it, you've both got to make findings regarding the alternatives. And in this case, if you agree with the conclusion of the preparers of the EIR that those impacts remain potentially significant,
then you need to make a statement of overriding considerations.
And that's due to the fact that those impacts are beyond our control.
Largely, I think they are.
I think I'm kind of getting it.
They're based on the limited capacity for the roads to handle the traffic that would be generated and the limited amount of water in the community primarily, but other resource constraints as well. Generally speaking, from the perspective of attempting to defend a decision that the county makes, it's easier to explain why something is a significant impact and make a statement of overriding considerations than it is to attempt to defend a statement that it's not really significant. So from my perspective, I would prefer, if there's going to be any error, that we err on the side of explaining why we think something is significant and also adequately explaining why it should be overridden and the plan adopted anyway. That would be my preferred path if that's the choice we find ourselves in.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so I kind of heard you agreeing with Ms. Christie to add the other on the language you have on the screen to add other issues other than just water and traffic.
Yeah, right? I think it's important, as you've pointed out, what the Planning Commission is doing is recommending what the board should do. I think if the Planning Commission feels that there's evidence in the record to support those conclusions, then it should make that extra statement that was stated there by Ms. Christie.
I tend to agree that, where can we go wrong in saying, well, there are other issues? Obviously, water and traffic are the big ones, but there are other ones that we've skirted, we've got around them, but we still considered them.
Yeah. No, that's fine. I agree that in practice, the plan we're adopting is preferable. It will result in less impact to the forest and a number of other things. I just want to make sure that we weren't getting in the way of the technical aspects of this and the specific things we had to find under CEQA. So no, I'm fine with putting in that if it doesn't compromise our ability to make the clear findings we need for CEQA.
Okay, we got three. Can we have four and five? It's unanimous. All right, we're going there. What's
and next? Actually, I could add the language if Commissioner Christie wanted to read.
Right, that's state. What we're asking you to
placing less demand on the water supply and other natural resources. Well, I'd put that after water because water is a natural resource as opposed to traffic circulation.
Okay. What else do we need to do here? I did hear another theme.
Referenced 5C as being inconsistent with our actions, previous actions.
Is he a doctor? His reading, his writing.
Here's some proposed revised language. While the decreased development plan alternative achieves the project goals and is environmentally superior to the project initially described in the EIR, it is not environmentally superior to the project as revised by the Planning Commission.
Whoa, that sounds kind of like a double negative. Could you read that again?
While the decreased development plan alternative achieves the project goals and is environmentally superior to the project initially described in the EIR, it is not environmentally superior to the project as revised by the Planning Commission.
Okay.
So it's stating that it is environmentally superior to the public hearing draft,
yeah,
but not superior to the Planning Commission recommended.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, we got. Is that unanimous? We're going with that? All right.
And then this is just a technical question that Mr. Ryburn raised, and maybe this is a question for our council. Since the EIR concluded that the no-growth alternative has the least amount of environmental consequences, you know, technically do we have to make that the environmentally superior alternative, but then the draft as revised by the Planning Commission is the one we're recommending, and then therefore the overriding considerations kick in?
Tim McNulty again. No, you don't. The CEQA guidelines specifically allow for the possibility that the hearing body will reach a different conclusion than the preparers of the EIR with regard to whether something's the environmentally superior alternative or not. I think particularly in this case where the project that was analyzed by the EIR preparers and submitted for comment review has changed significantly since it was presented here, or changed to some great degree. I think the statement that was just read into the record is supported by what the Planning Commission has done with the project that it received.
And I totally agree, but it just seems kind of...
I think the language that's referred to in Mr. Ryburn's letter is language that was in that original draft that was circulated, but I don't think that that's the existing state of affairs any longer.
Okay, because it just seems like, on an intuitive level, it's just obvious that no growth in Cambria would be less of an environmental impact than any growth in Cambria, but the reality is that'll never happen, and I just wondered if we had to do some legal two-step to get from the truly environmentally superior alternative to the one that we're recommending to the board.
No, you do have an obligation to explain why you're rejecting alternatives in your findings, but beyond that, you don't. And I should also point out something that I haven't commented on until now because I didn't want to complicate the situation, but in this particular function that the Planning Commission and the Board is involved in, that is the environmental review of an amendment to the local coastal plan, there's been some case law developments, a case out of Santa Barbara involving nursery growers, involving an amendment to their LCP about nurseries in the Carpinteria area, where the court concluded that you really don't need to do CEQA analysis at all.
So in other words, never mind.
It's not been the approach that we recommended because it's just the one case that supports that proposition so far, but it's quite possible. And I think when this project gets to the Board of Supervisors, I'll recommend that the Board also make a finding that if in the event that all of this stuff is somehow flawed, look at the nursery growers case, because essentially what it says is that the Coastal Commission's process of reviewing LCP amendments is the equivalent of the California Environmental Quality Act review, and that furthermore, that protection applies to local governments that are attempting to amend their LCPs and submit them to the Coastal Commission. At least that was the decision of the Court of Appeal in Ventura, which is the Court of Appeal that our court answers to. So
I'm glad you cleared that up for us. Okay, I think we've got dealt with most everything, but I did hear some concerns that we were somehow taking away property rights, and let me see if I got it right. The plan as it's that we're working under right now has got some perhaps 11,000 buildings that could, residences that could exist in Cambria if everybody built on their lots. And the services district has analyzed their water situation and says we can get to 4650, but it would be really tough to get any further. So what our plan has done is we've dropped it down to 7,000, but correct me if I'm wrong, we didn't go to any clearly identifiable, and I don't know Mr. Kempner's or Mr. Lynch's lots, but I'm assuming they're residential single-family lots that exist somewhere.
And right.
We didn't make any map changes to make them right. Open space or something like that.
Correct.
Okay. Now, so we got the 7,000 number, and the services district wants a lower number, and that's a build-out reduction plan, and could you, someone kind of summarize that?
Well, the plan has an ultimate build-out about 6,130.
Okay.
And then there's programs within the plan that, such as open space district, lot consolidation, transfer development credits to further reduce that. And along with those programs is the CCSD's build-out reduction plan, which they're working on to reduce it down to the 4650.
So, and County Council, could you assure us that we haven't taken somebody's right away by recommending these programs? Their lot value still exists today and will tomorrow if this is approved?
I don't know. That's a bit much to ensure.
Well, barring other issues.
What I think the Planning Commission has done is to attempt to craft a land use plan that addresses the resource constraints that exist in the community and has done that in a way that hopefully works in conjunction with the Cambria's CSD's plan for lot reduction. I don't think the Planning Commission has adopted the lot reduction plan. I don't think we've incorporated that into the LCP. I think that's something that is going to be carried out by the Cambria Community Services District. I do, however, think that our plan is and can be consistent with their lot reduction plan, and the ultimate numbers of both agencies don't conflict with each other. So I think it should work in that way.
If we were really concerned about consistency, couldn't we build the 4650 number into the LCP so that regardless of, you know, changes on the CSD board or the rate at which their programs get implemented, that the 4650, which we all agree is the CSD's maximum ability to provide, is mirrored and codified in the LCP?
Yeah, I suppose you could. I don't know whether we're in a position to do that now because we don't know what the lot reduction plan looks like in any great detail. We've heard a couple of talks about it, but we don't have it. I don't believe it's yet final, or I haven't reviewed it in any event. So, in other words, if we were to try to do that, I'm not sure we've got the record yet to support a limiting number like that.
But the record that I would think would support that is the CSD's testimony that that's how much water they can provide. And we take them at their word. And so if that's how much water, you know, our county's responsibility is to, you know, approve land uses. Their responsibility is to provide water. And so if they can only provide water up to 4650, it's, and we're in agreement with that, it seems like it would track to limit our land use planning document to 4650 dwelling units.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of complications in what you just said. I know that because I've listened to their testimony, I know what the goal is that they're trying to achieve and what they think that the community can reasonably accommodate in terms of growth, and that's what they're shooting for there. I don't know whether we've got a record that would support necessarily finding that we have to limit the number of lots there. I mean, if we were to do it based on what we know today, we'd say, look, there is no more water, there's a moratorium, there shouldn't be anything happening at all in the community. And yet, obviously, we're not doing that either.
Well, I, for one, couldn't support that. I'm comfortable with our 6,100 number, and that we in the community are not done yet, but for this process, we're at 6,100.
I think it's probably in our interest to have the CSD determine when and where water allocations should be issued and have the county try to come up with a plan that doesn't hinder their efforts to do that. So, and I think that's what you've gotten pretty close to doing.
But we do hinder their efforts. If we set up a land use planning document that allows for more growth than they can provide water for, I mean, we set up, you know, difficulties for them, and we set up difficulties for the county, and we set up difficulties for the public who develops expectations about their, you know, ability to build on their lots.
Okay. Ms. Rappin had a question.
I just have a very quick question for staff. One of the recommendations that we're making is to amend the Cambria design plan and incorporating that into the standards in the area plan. If I have a piece of property that I own and I want to build a carport or a garage or something like that, and I am not in an overlay area, I'm not requesting any variances or any changes, do I still need to get a minor use permit? Because I've been asked this question and I don't know the answer.
If you're not in an appealable area and it's an afternoon.
And I guess we can, you know, say the glass is half full and say at least we got it before we took our action on the item. In my glancing through it while we were, you know, having this discussion, I saw that, as Ms. Nieder had indicated, some of the issues have already been addressed. But I've also, there's also obviously some things that we haven't addressed. And so I would suggest that rather than basically, I mean, this is really where the rubber meets the road. The question is the County of San Luis Obispo going to prepare a document that's going to pass muster with the Coastal Commission and allow it to be certified? And I guess I'm going to end our discussions where I started the discussions, which is the responsible thing to do is to put forward a document that we feel comes as close to meeting that test as is realistically possible, because nobody wants to see all of the effort that's gone into this plan go, you know, down the tubes yet again. So I think this letter from the Coastal Commission is a huge resource for us in that it's a roadmap. It's the state agency that has to approve this thing, telling us exactly, what needs to be addressed. And I would suggest that it is it's a better idea to have staff take some time to read this letter, take some time to go over the changes that we've made, analyze what is still outstanding, and address those outstanding issues here at the Planning Commission level, because I just think it's a fundamental part of our charge that we undertake that analysis, we undertake that discussion, and what we send to the Board of Supervisors is something that we have thoroughly considered, as opposed to just say, oh, well, here's the regulatory agency's comments, you people deal with it. So that would be my suggestion, rather than taking final action on the EIR today, that we defer that until we've had a chance to analyze and respond to and make any necessary changes that would come out of a more thorough reading of the Coastal Commission's comments.
It's actually the Coastal Commission staff's comments. It isn't the commission. I can read the name on the last page.
It's an agency. The agency is referred to as the California Coastal Commission.
Okay, I would agree with you if they had given it to us in a timely manner. They know darn well when our hearing was. You know, to give us, deliver something at 5 minutes after five, the day before the hearing, is just, that tells me a lot. And I'm not ready to address that.
Chairman Rose,
today,
with all due respect, the Coastal Commission has a long history of being significantly underfunded, understaffed, under the gun to meet statutory deadlines in a manner that has created a workload that is literally crushing. It's amazing that the staff is able to turn out the work product that they do in the time frame that they have. Would it have been better to have received this weeks or months ago? Absolutely. There's no question. It's late in the process, but the process hasn't yet been completed. They've taken the time to review and analyze the plan and to send their suggestion and comments to us. I don't see any reason why we can't take the time needed to respond to those changes or not before we send this to the board.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have staff response to this. Here's staff's comments.
Ms. Nieder?
Well, the Planning Commission review of the plan is one step in the process, and these comments will not be ignored. In fact, we will take the opportunity between the Planning Commission hearings and when we go to the board to work with the Commission staff on this and all their comments. We agree. We do not want to put forward a plan that is essentially going to go to the Coastal Commission and end there. And I think we've made significant strides in incorporating as many comments as feasible in all the documents that the Coastal Commission has commented on our LCP with, the periodic review, the suggested mods. And after we go to the Board of Supervisors, the Board of Supervisors adopted plan goes to the Coastal Commission for their review. So there's this ongoing dialogue with the Coastal Commission. It doesn't end today. This is one step in a long process. There'll be many discussions with the Coastal Commission staff, and we feel
revisions of the Cambria and San Simeon Acres community plans, of the North Coast Area Plan, amendments to the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance and the Cambria Design Plan, and certify and recommend that the Board of Supervisors certify the final EIR for this project.
I'll second that.
Discussion? Roll call.
Commissioner Gibson?
Yes.
Commissioner Christie?
Mr. Melskow.
I'll take a pass.
Yes.
Commissioner Rappa?
Yes.
Commissioner Christie?
Oh, come on. Go with this.
You know, I was really looking forward to voting aye on this. But in all good conscience, I feel like we are sending the Board of Supervisors an incomplete document, that we're affirmatively turning our back on our obligation to reach in and do the additional work that needs to be done to respond to the Coastal Commission's comments. And so it's with a heavy heart, after all of the work and I think very substantial improvements that we've made to the draft document, I don't feel it's done. And so, regrettably, I'm going to have to vote no.
Okay, be encouraged in how short this letter is, really.
Yeah, absolutely. It wouldn't take a lot of time. It's much shorter than the Estero letter.
Okay.
Chairman Rose.
Yes. And with that, we've completed that action, and I'm pleased. And I thank everybody for their participation in this matter.
In particular, Ms. Nieder, for her extraordinary patience with all parties and the competence of her work.
And well done.
Thank
I agree.
You.
And with that, we'll take our morning break and come back here at 10:30. Okay, I'll call this meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission back in session. And could we introduce the next item, please?
Hearing to consider a request by Frank Parnell for a variance coastal development permit to allow a setback variance of the rear and side setbacks for a 675-square-foot enclosed patio structure with walls built on the property line. This site is in the San Luis Bay Coastal Planning Area, County File Number DRC-2004-00224, Supervisorial District 4, Marshall Lee, Project Manager.
And before we get started, I must disclose that I drove by the property. I didn't see anybody there, but I just walked around and whatnot. And I also called Mr. Belcher, who I believe is representing various people today, and I says, "You always give me stuff as you start talking, so would you be so kind as to get it to us prior to you starting talking?" And he did, and I thank him for that.
Good morning, members of the Commission. Marshall Lee, staff planner. The approval of this project would result in zero setbacks for portions of the rear and side property lines. Required setbacks are 3 feet on the side and 10 feet in the rear. The site is located at 1560 Strandway in the community of Oceano. It is in the residential multifamily land use category. This is an aerial that shows the site located on the adjacent to the Oceano Dune State Park area.
Wait a minute, don't go too far because she's going to give us that aerial. And there we got it.
Okay, this is the aerial. Shows it. The site adjacent to the Oceano Dune State Park area. Key issues related to this request include unauthorized construction extending into the rear and side setbacks, fire safety and access, and roof runoff on adjacent property. This is a photo of the rear of the property as viewed from the ocean, and it shows the subject property and the property to the north. The arrow shows the edge of the enclosure of the patio that is on the property line. This is the subject property with the adjacent home to the south that shows the edge of the property in relationship to the house, to the south. This is the as-built shows the setback of 7 feet to the top floor, right here, 7 feet to the top floor extension, enclosed patio, and then right here is the property line where the bottom deck enclosure extends. Projections for the deck can occupy 30% of the setback, so that in fact the 7 feet here is meets the ordinance standards. The following four slides show historic photos that from the California Coastal .org project. In the center of the screen here is the subject property in 1987 when it was built. This is a 1989 that shows the what looks like the patio area beginning.
Wait, we'll back up there. That was in 1989, and you said they applied for a...
They applied for a building permit for the enclosure on the top up here in 1997 was the patio enclosure. This here shows in 1989, a couple years after it was built. It looks like it's just the walls of the patio, the bottom patio.
And that was not in the original permit.
No.
So we have a violation in this picture right here.
It looks like it. Well, the hard part to tell is that I can't see if there is a cover here or not. If there's no cover, then it's just like a fence kind of area. See, because these are openings right here.
But so wouldn't that have needed? Shouldn't that have been described in their plans when they applied for their permit?
On the property line for the fencing in 1987, probably should be, but.
Good morning. Matt Jansen, planning staff. Are you referring to the original permit that they should have received from the Coastal Commission?
Well, and that was a question I was going to ask later, but as I understand the situation, we don't have a permit issued by the Coastal Commission. I don't know whether... I mean, maybe that's a question to ask now. Did the commission indicate that there wasn't one or that they just couldn't find it?
They indicated they couldn't find it.
So was there any indication that it might be somewhere that, you know, like in storage or we've moved those files?
I was unable to get that from the Coastal Commission.
Well, has the applicant, the property owner... come forward with a copy of their coastal development permit?
No, but maybe they have it today, though.
Okay, because absent that, I think we have to assume that the entire structure, technically, is a violation because it went forward without a CDP. But that's a separate question to the one that brought us to this moment, which is, did the county's building permit that we issued that we do have... Does that include the constructed patio area?
No.
So whether it's covered or not, it's a VIO. That would be my conclusion. It's not on the permit. It's not part of the approved plans. Okay. I mean, does staff agree with that conclusion?
It looks like you're right. Okay, so this is 1989, and then we have 2002, which shows... the project, which has the enclosed patio on the top, which was the subject of the building permit in 97, and then this enclosure, which I don't have permits for. And here you have in 2004 another view of the same structure. The house to the south is not built yet because it's under construction right now. The next slides show some of the slides of the area of what is there into the attachment to the structures. This is the subject property here extending out to the property line, adjacent decks to the north. This is a typical where you have the 3 foot and the 3 foot and you do have fencing, but it's pretty well, you know, 3 feet and 3 feet. Here's another fence denial of the request for the variance in the coastal development permit based on the findings listed in Exhibit A.
Okay, questions for staff, and I know we have a very busy schedule today, and I had thought in order to kind of smooth this process along, I'd try to instigate something new here today, if the rest of the commission would agree, that on these projects we'd ask the district commissioner to ask his questions first, and we wouldn't interrupt him, even if we want to segue off of his traffic point or whatever, and then each one of us in turn ask our questions, and then at the end of that time, then we can get this back and forth that we sometimes takes a while. And I already violated it earlier.
You hadn't instituted it yet.
But I hadn't instituted it yet. You know? Okay. Gene.
All right. I only have one question, and that is, it appears to me that this structure was built, this enclosed patio was built without a building permit. And I don't, is that true?
It appears.
Yeah. So, unless I can be shown otherwise, I would have to deny it.
Other commissioners.
My only question was the official position of the fire department in that area is that this constitutes a hazard?
Yes.
Okay. Very quickly. On 2-36, 2-37, 2-38 and 39. Could you just reference the dates of those construction permits? It's a little unclear to me. 2-36 is the grading permit. Is that correct?
Right. This is 87 when it was built. This is the building permit for the project.
And 2-37 is also that.
Yes. And then on the next 38 is the site elevation for the same. That would be the same. And then the following 37 is the patio enclosure. 86. Now that's still a building permit.
Ms. Lee, 238. The stamp, the received stamp, looks like it says March 81, I think, up in the upper right-hand corner. March 31. No date. I mean, no year date.
Well, you expect perfection there?
Oh, I was thinking that was maybe 81 as in 1981. But no.
Okay. Continuing on, Ms. Rappa.
Well, I think that's my question. 2-38, I can't tell what year it is. 2-39, it looks to me like it's 86.
Mm-hmm. This is that is still part of the building, original building permit that shows the setback of 10 feet there. It's the 7 feet to the upper deck there.
So that part there was a building permit issued for?
That was the 87 first permit. The plot plan on 43 is for the proposed patio enclosure on the upper deck. So that's for 243.
Okay. Now, 2-44 references 97, which is, I think, the question that came into the part that came into question. The slide that you showed of 97, of which, at least from what I heard, there was no application, but I do see an inspection record.
It's 87, excuse me. It's 87 and 97 that we're mixing up here.
Let me take a stab at it. In late 80s, we issued a ministerial building permit of which there's no record of a discretionary coastal development permit for the entire house.
Got it.
We did not have permit jurisdiction at
Correct.
That time, so that it would have had to come from the agency itself.
Correct.
I think I have all that straight.
So in 97, they came forward with a proposal to have a second-story addition, and we inspected that and finaled that. But there is no permit history for the first floor addition that occurred.
Okay. And the date we think that occurred, according to these records or aerial pictures?
It's hard for us to pinpoint that. I think the applicant could do a much, much better
okay.
job of that.
I'll wait.
Okay. Mr. Gibson?
Fine.
Okay.
The inspector wasn't there to inspect work that wasn't permitted. Mm-hmm. So we don't consider that a sign-off of unpermitted work.
Okay, here's a hypothetical that if the you issued this permit based on this plot plan, and in fact they didn't follow that, but the inspector didn't catch it and he signed off, does that somehow make that okay, even though it violates what the plot plan that you in the department approved?
I would like counsel to respond to that.
And I would, too.
Well, I'd like to have all the testimony of the applicant in, but that seems to be part of the crux of the issue here.
You bet.
The case that the applicant has cited, the La Mesa case, had a permit that was issued that was constructed in accordance with that permit. And it was subsequently that the city said there was another zoning requirement.
But my hypothetical was if they approved something based on a plot plan that appeared to meet all the requirements, but in fact, not saying they did, but some applicant built something that didn't meet that plot plan and violated some ordinance or setback requirement or something, but the inspector mistakenly approved that, what's the legal status of that? It violates what he or she asked for, but in fact, the guy approved it.
Well, I think that county staff would argue that we're not a stop to do it because the construction was not in accordance with the approved permit. They did something different, and even if it got finaled, it still wasn't in accordance with the approved permit. I think the applicant would probably argue the other way. But
okay. Well,
I don't think that's an applicable hypothetical because we're talking about the lower deck,
right,
which
right.
never got a permit.
Okay. We'll see.
And I would only observe on 243 that the plot plan there appears to be incorrectly drawn. There is a notation of existing lower roof that appears to conform with the 3-foot setbacks, mm-hmm. but clearly that roof as right. it exists today goes to the property line. Right. So I only offer that as an observation for future discussion.
Okay.
I think there's also speculation about what was built when the inspector went out. I haven't heard that the staff say that it was built as it is today. I think there was speculation about what was there.
Well, we'll hear from the applicant. We've given him plenty of things to talk to. Any other questions for staff? Well, seeing none, I'll open up the public hearing and ask the applicant or his agent to come forward and make a presentation. Don't give us any more papers, Mr. Belcher. We got enough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll certainly provide additional papers for you in the course of the hearing today.
All right.
But hopefully in the form of pictures.
Okay, pictures.
It'll be much easier to digest than the written materials. The applicant here is not proud of the fact that we ended up here at this meeting.
You got to say who you are, though.
I'm John Belcher. I'm representing Frank and Jan Parnell, who have lived and built the house in question and lived in it since 1987. And they thought everything was fine until they got a notice from somebody not too long ago that said, gee, by the way, your house isn't legal, which was news to them. Now, we're going to talk about the history of this project, but you need to understand that the Parnells had all those drawings made by their contractors. He's not a designer or an architect. They just hired people to build things, had them inspected, and then paid to have them built, and then lived in their house. That's the extent of their involvement. And They've been trying to work out things with the planning staff for a good deal of months in terms of what's the definition of a patio, what's the definition of a house, what's the definition of a structure, what's the definition of a fence, what's the definition of a roof. And the reason that this is all, being presented this as, well, he's got an enclosed patio, therefore it's illegal. Well, what the planning staff isn't telling you is that the building staff and the planning staff have been grappling with these definitional issues for months. So finally we're here on a variance application because under this California law, as Mr. Orton has observed, there is case law that says that in some cases where you build structures that don't meet your zoning requirements, in some cases you're allowed to obtain a variance. Doesn't create a precedent for all the other people along the row of houses here that have similar encroachments. It doesn't do anything except a one-time exception based on the hardship to this applicant because they thought they were following the rules. They tried to follow the rules. They got inspections. And lo and behold, it turns out that they don't meet the particular definition. At this moment, we've considered this an issue for the county. Now, I can appreciate that the Coastal Commission has its rules and jurisdiction, and the county has its rules and jurisdiction, which are part and parcel of the local coastal plan. So I think the Coastal Commission's jurisdiction here today and this commission is charged with enforcing the county's ordinances and the rules under California law. Now, what happened in 1987 is the home that you observed in the aerial photos was constructed by the Parnells. At the same time they built the home, they built the walls that enclose the patio. This patio doesn't have air conditioning or heating, doesn't have plumbing, it has some electrical, but it has basically, it's an outdoor patio that in 1987 was built and enclosed on the property lines at the time the house was built and inspected and cleared by the County of San Luis Obispo. At that time, that patio had glass roof on it. And that's why it's a little difficult in the 1987 photo and the 1989 photo to tell. But that roof was glass, and the glass had panels that sat up on top of this patio enclosure. At that time, apparently, everybody in the county felt that was an okay backyard improvement. And since it was built at the same time as the house, you would assume that the owners of the house have the right to rely on the inspections of the county. And as counsel pointed out, the leading case in this matter, Anderson versus La Mesa, the house wasn't built in a way that they determined was in compliance with the zoning ordinances. Now, counsel says that it was built in compliance with the plans. I'm not so sure that's clear from the case. But in any event, it got inspected, and the court made a big deal out of the fact that it was inspected like five or six times and passed inspection. 10 years later, Mr. Parnell wanted to add an upper deck enclosure, and he applied for a permit to do that. At the same time, his contractor replaced the glass panels that are on the patio because they were leaking and unacceptable in terms of his use of the patio underneath from a health perspective with the ceramic tile that matched the roof tile. That was also inspected, and at the time the permit was issued, which was labeled patio enclosure. So although the drawings might not be accurate enough for us to make a determination what was correct or not, or maybe they're even in error, there wasn't any attempt to hide the fact that there was a patio enclosure involved here, and this was fully inspected. I'd like to put up the inspection card.
Other way.
It doesn't fit. It doesn't fit long enough.
Yeah, and the date that, can you read that date at the bottom?
The date at the top is February 28, 1997.
Oh. Ms. Christie answered my question here for me.
Well, and I'm curious, there's a line through a lot of that stuff with an NA.
That means there weren't inspections for those subject matters.
Right, so
you're not quite on the mic yet, Eric. Got to push some more buttons, or
so that would seem to indicate that while they were doing an inspection, they were doing an inspection for very specific
So when you have a remodel of this limited nature where all you're doing is putting up walls and some electrical, all they sign off is walls and electrical. There wasn't any plumbing, so they just cross out all this other stuff.
Right.
So this is a final inspection on the patio enclosure. If you look at the top of the chart, it's listed as a patio enclosure. Now, Mr. Parnell had at that time, and there are copies of this, which I think are in the file. It's in one of the pages. Of your staff report, so you can look at it yourselves. And anybody find the page where that is?
243.
So, pursuant to that permit, he encloses the upstairs and he rebuilds the, he just replaces the glass enclosed roof with a tile enclosed roof. The whole thing is signed off. He goes along his way, and then a few years later, there comes somebody knocking on his door and says, gee, that's illegal. And then since that time, we've been struggling with the definitions and the applications, and we've resulted in what I feel is really basically the ultimate result of this thing, is I think that either the county will grant a variance for this existing, already inspected structure, or the courts will. So that's why we're here. Now, I'd like to show you some photographs because one of the issues that's raised whenever you have these kind of Anderson versus La Mesa previously inspected retro that is different than everybody else in the neighborhood or other people in the neighborhood. So I'd like to walk through a couple photographs that I think might lend a little bit of light on these subjects. Up above, what you have at, you can see at 1402 Strand Way, you have an enclosed but it doesn't have a roof on it, patio that goes to the roof line. Now, if you look at the photograph below it, you'll see the house next to it at 1432 Strandway, which has an extensive stair structure that is built entirely within the rear setback area. You also have an enclosed patio on the property immediately next door to it. It's obvious to me that these houses do not have access between them for fire access, and they are built fully out to the property line. So if someone wants to say that a fence on the property line violates the Coastal Act, then we got dozens of them, and we're just going to have a great old time tearing up the neighborhood if we're going to get into that stuff. Okay, next picture. This is a property immediately across the street at 316 Surf. This photograph, oh, by the way, I have copies of these, which I'll distribute.
Stuff. Just pictures, though. Oh, okay. Just pictures. Just pictures. No writing. Good.
Okay, so we just looked at the first one, and you'll be able to see the second one a little bit better, I think, with these photos in front of you. Basically, what's happened is in the photograph on the second page, you got construction right into the 3-foot setback. You got fences, you got storage sheds, you got basically no access, period, for the fire department between this building. The picture below at 1402 Strand Way, that's a picture of the fire department access between the two buildings at 1402 Strand Way. It looks like about 6 inches. The next page. The top picture, you'll see a newer building there on the left. That building is newly permitted on the Strand. It was built right to the allowable setback by the Coastal Commission and the county staff. The building next to it is not built to that same setback. That building is much closer to the setback, within 5 feet probably. That's a wholly enclosed living area with heating and air conditioning and everything else. I suppose that will be the next one on the hit list for enforcement if we go the route I think we're going to go here today. So we've got that house. We also have a house immediately below at 318 Surf. Again, this is a picture of encroachments built right to the property line, which is pretty common in that neighborhood. If you turn to the next page, got another photograph of 1402 Strand and the fire department access between those two buildings. The next bottom picture is another picture of 316 Surf showing the kind of encroachments, fences, other things between these houses. If you'll turn to the next page, you'll see another example of fence encroachments into the setbacks between the buildings. I'm not saying it's not a problem. I'm just talking about what's a special privilege for the neighborhood. If we turn to the staff, Ms. Lee's photographs, I think number two or three on the slideshow, could you pull that up for me, please? I want to take a look at the setbacks that exist in the field for this structure. Okay, you'll see the home to the north and the home to the south. You've got a clear walkway between the two properties, which both properties, by the way, owners have agreed on this and worked it out so that there's access between their two buildings, more than many of the other buildings in the neighborhood. If you could turn to the next picture, please. If you look at the access here, this building is built with its 3-foot setback. This is by property owners you're going to hear from in a few minutes to the south. If you turn to the next picture, though, that picture doesn't show. See the wall on the left? If you'll turn back to the picture previous beforehand. This picture is the one that your staff shows representing the house that I think is just about getting its occupancy permit. I'm not sure which. There's no wall in front of this house. So in the next picture, you're going to see the wall that they built on the property line there. That wall goes 6 inches to our property line. So we don't know what's going to go on top of it. I'm guessing there'll be glass panels on top of that wall. And I'm thinking maybe the fire access isn't going to be all that great between these two buildings at that point. The water pipe that you see passing down that wall was there for many years while that was a vacant lot. That has been removed. There are... There's a quote, which I will pass out in a moment, from Bobcat Rain Gutters that was secured by my client, which will take all the water from his property. So now that provides all. I provided you with all the documents that we have that I think shed some light on this, in addition to the things that the staff has provided to you. I think the question for you today, in conjunction with your counsel, is, does this history amount to an inspection of an otherwise illegal structure such that the applicant is entitled to a variance on a one-time basis, not creating a precedent, but does not create a special privilege in the neighborhood that somehow is going to void that use, such that you can grant the variance for this one-time instance and we can sort of end the 3 years of argument about building codes and structures and walls and fences and everything else. So that concludes our presentation. We'd like a few minutes to respond after we hear from the neighborhood and the council and the commission's comments, if that's possible, before the public hearing closes. And with that, we'll hopefully answer any questions you might have.
Certainly. Thank you. I have several speaker slips. Mitch Cooney, if you would take a microphone. And Linda Austin, if you would take the opposite one.
Good morning. My name is Mitch Cooney. I'm the general manager of the Oceano Community Service District. The Oceano Fire Department feels that granting the requested variance could cause an impediment to emergency access to the subject property and those adjacent to it, particularly since the sandy terrain on one exposure would prevent fire apparatus from any form of access. Granting the variance could endanger property and the safety and lives of the firefighters who respond to an incident in the area. The Oceano Fire Department concurs with staff's recommendation that the variance be denied. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes, quick question, Mr. Cooney. Does the Oceano Fire Department sign off on construction permit applications in terms of fire safety consistently in Oceano?
Yes, sir.
And we saw a minute ago that a block wall had been constructed that abuts the subject property from the property to the south. Does the fire department have any concerns about fire access on that particular structure?
We sign off on the plans. We don't actually physically go out and see the facility itself. When we sign off on the fire safety, it's based on the plans that are submitted.
But your assessment, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that your assessment on signing off on plans for new construction is that you have sufficient access to get all the way to the beach between two structures.
Correct.
on every new structure that goes in there.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, if there are no other questions, I had one, and it looks like, in my observation, as well as staff's and Mr. Belcher's presentations, there are lots of properties where there's no way you're going to get anybody down there or any equipment, and I would bet you have a concern on that.
Absolutely, but we're only being asked to address this particular item right now. Okay. I would certainly be, you know, talking about the other items if those were to come up also.
But I'd be correct in assuming that those pictures you saw, you have a concern about those from the firefighter safety and as well as property.
It's access, because as you know, there's only, you know, there's a road called Strand Avenue that really doesn't exist. If you look at the map, it looks very nice.
It's pretty small.
Well, it just doesn't exist. I mean, in front of those homes, it's just sand dunes. And we have no engine that could get out there to address a fire situation.
Okay. Other questions?
Well, do you have any kind of proactive program? I mean, it's pretty obvious to me that this is throughout the area, this concern that you've raised or that the services district has raised.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by a proactive program?
You only act on a complaint basis?
Well, we do review the, you know, the county is the one who sets up the standards as far as the setback goes, and we can live with the setback if they're maintained.
Well, it's pretty obvious that they haven't been maintained, not just here, but in many instances, many, many.
We understand.
And do you have a proactive program to address this concern?
The concerns are addressed through the Oceano Halcyon Advisory Committee, and I think we did address those at the time. We did appear before the Oceano Halcyon Advisory Committee, and they have our response that
on this particular project.
Yes,
I'm just speaking in general.
Well, we address projects as they come to us. I mean, if the project is built, you know, and there's a complaint, and somebody, you know, comes to us and wants to know what the fire department's concerns are, we would certainly express them with their plans, and we do request that they sprinkle them. We tell them that, of course, their insurance would be much less if they were to sprinkler them. There is a minimum size for sprinkling, but just a regular, you know, 2,000 square foot home doesn't require sprinkling.
Okay, let me just try very quickly one more time. Okay. Of the other properties that exist that also are built to the setback, to the property lines, are you taking any action at all? Thank you.
And I'm sorry, I didn't write your name down.
Mitch Cooney.
Mitch Cooney. You're a services district director or general manager?
The general manager.
General manager. Do you know of any services districts around the county or elsewhere that have land use planning enforcement divisions that would go around and inspect properties to see if they're in compliance with the permits that you approved?
I don't believe it's part of the charter under 61,000 of the government code. I don't believe that community service districts have that ability.
Thank you.
Thank you. Linda Austin, and that's the last speaker slip I have.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My name's Linda Austin. I reside in Oceano. My family owns a home directly to the south of 1560 Strandway. We are here today to ask for a denial of the requested variance. I gave a handout to you this morning with two pictures. If you could put the picture number one.
Handout. I got plenty of handouts.
That's number two. Yes. This picture here that you have in the packet I handed out, it's labeled Exhibit A. It shows the two homes from the beach side looking towards Strand Way. And
What it shows here is that the setback is enclosed with a tile roof. Any access to 1560 Strand on this side of the residence for any maintenance or repairs or for any emergencies would have to come from our property. If you want to do anything on the top section of the house, you would have to put a ladder on our property to get to the, to get to your property. On the second picture, Exhibit B, you can see here looking from Strand way down that there is just the 3 feet between our homes. There are no other homes in the Strand area or in the entire Beecher where the owners have enclosed the setback with a roof onto the property line. This is a roof attached to the residence that comes out and encloses all access. On some of the pictures that were presented by Mr. Belcher, I'm quite familiar with the other homes there, and you can get between both homes. There's a fence between the homes, and someone may have put patio and enclosure on top of their wall, but you can walk between. You have a property line, you'll have 3 feet on one side and 3 feet on the other side, and we do not have that here. And as to the rain gutters, if you could put this picture up, please. This is a view of the supposed to be the party wall between the homes with this structure with the tile roof built on top. This is taken from our upper deck looking down. So if you were to put, I'd like to know where rain gutters would go, because that side of the roof is on our property, and I would think a rain gutter would have to be on our property, and I don't know if that would, you know, I don't think we would agree to having rain gutters installed on our property for his runoff. This structure is illegal. It doesn't fit any criteria for a variance. It's a safety hazard. It's detrimental to the health and welfare of all the other people living in the Strand area. In regards to Anderson versus La Mesa, I read that order. It was the reason that Anderson did not affect any other property owners. It did not have any effect, and that's why it was they won that case. It was just a simple thing, but the setback was supposed to be 10 feet, and they had 5 feet. It wasn't didn't have any adverse effect on anyone else.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyone else? Seeing none, Mr. Belcher, my concluding remarks? Brief concluding remarks.
Well,
Say your name again.
You just introduced me.
She doesn't trust me.
John Belcher. The case of Anderson versus La Mesa is a unique case in California courts dealing with estoppel. There's another case that has fought that big a deal. I think the representation that all the homes in the area have 6 feet of access, it's not, I mean, I don't know. You can look at the photographs and reach your own conclusion about that. You know, the reality is that this whole episode is a result of a complaint filed by the previous speaker when they were getting ready to build their lot, their house, on their lot. They've now completed their construction. You know, I don't believe that Mr. Parnell's house impacts them in any way, and I don't think that this patio impacts them in any way. And I think that the fairest thing to do is to grant an exemption for this property owner and allow him to live out the rest of his years in his house that he built in 1987 and was inspected and approved twice by the County of San Luis Obispo. Thank you.
Thank you. I had a question for you. Ms. Austin stated that she thought that the gutter, certainly the gutter and perhaps the existing tiles extend onto her property line. Do you have an opinion on that?
I don't have an opinion about that. If she's got a civil action to file, let's bring it on. This isn't where we resolve those issues. I don't believe it's an encroachment. I don't believe the rain gutters are going to be an encroachment either.
Well, as I looked down the property line, and I didn't find any survey stakes, okay, but it looked to me as it did, but again, I'm not a surveyor.
She didn't provide a survey, so I just don't know what to make of that testimony. I think she can hire a lawyer. She comes sue us, and I'll defend Mr. Parnell, and we'll figure it out. But that's not really the issue before the commission.
One other question I had for you. On page 43 of our staff report, there's a plot plan provided that talks about an existing lower roof, and this was submitted in 97. Am I correct on that?
That's right. That's what it says.
And it shows, at least the picture that I'm looking at, shows that the existing lower roof respected the 3-foot setback. But I have heard testimony and looked at pictures so far, I don't believe that's the case. Convince me that's not true.
We can all agree that's not an accurate representation of where the roof was or the structure. It was built to the property lines at that time. We've got the aerial photographs to show it. The contractor who handled this in 1997, submitted this original drawing and marked it up to show the area of the second floor. And he labels the lower existing roof, but dimensionally, I don't think it's definitely not accurate. So, I mean, I think we can all agree that that's not an accurate.
Who labels the existing lower roof? This was not prepared by county.
No, this is prepared by his contractor.
By Mr. Parnell's contractor.
Mr. Day, that's right.
So Mr. Day prepared an inaccurate plan that was submitted to the county.
I think what he did, in all honesty, was photocopy a previous drawing and attach it to a construction permit application. And he wrote on here, existing lower roof. He didn't actually create this document. This document was already in the hopper.
So this document originally was part of the original application that the county considered and issued their permit based on.
It absolutely is.
With a 3-foot setback.
That's in the record today. Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
I'd like to just pursue that a little further in the accuracy of this and exactly what was permitted in each of 1987 and 1997. Because, Mr. Belcher, you've mentioned on a couple of times that the part of this structure that causes the need to come for a variance here, which is the lower floor, was inspected a couple of times. But in 1987, they got permits for something that we don't see. So we don't know what was permitted and what was inspected. We don't have those permits from 87. Is that correct?
Well, we absolutely know what was inspected. We're testifying today to the fact of what was inspected.
Okay, but
what was inspected is exactly what's there today with glass panels. What was permitted is a little bit unclear. We think that the drawing that the permit was issued on didn't show that enclosure of the patio on it. And the reason for that is that, as I learned in the last 2 years, it's not really all that clear where a patio enclosure becomes a structure. And I think what really happened is when it was all built, the retaining walls for the patio are the same retaining walls that are built the same time the house is built, all original stuff, is that the fences and the beams on top of the fence was all considered patio and was not considered a violation of any county law, ordinance, Coastal Commission regulation.
Okay,
it was all signed off.
Okay, but You're telling me it's all signed off, but we don't have the permits in front of us to see what was permitted and what was signed off on.
You don't have a signature card, but you have Mr. Parnell.
You have the testimony.
He can test the glass panels. He did it as part of his construction contract. The inspector was out there on more than one occasion, to our recollection, and saw the entirety of that operation. And furthermore, walked right on top of the setback issue. And if this inspector had an issue with the patio enclosure, And today's building department people say, well, we think it might be a structure as opposed to a patio. That was a call that could have been made in 1987 and could have been made in 1997.
Right. Okay.
That's the testimony. I'm not saying that this permit I don't know. This permit refers to the existing lower roof. Okay? If there was a roof and it was illegal, it doesn't matter. The lower roof would be illegal under their definitions, I suppose.
We don't need to take this too much further. My my questions and the substance of discussion are going to be on specifically the findings that are necessary for this commission to grant a variance. I just wanted to get your response to the question of whether the structure that actually causes the need for a variance to be requested was actually permitted, and I think there's a question to that. At this point, I'd leave it at that.
So now it's time to...
Last point I'd like to make is it's not multiple structures. There's just one structure. So it's all. This was all tied together, the construction of this lower upper deck extension thingy.
Thank you.
It's not like they were separated.
Just very quickly, Mr. Chairman, if you page 2-39, which is what was submitted to the county in 86, 87 when the house was built, is it your contention then that the lower patio enclosure is noted on that plot plan? It appears that way to me.
Yeah, I think that the lower patio stuff and the walls and everything were always part of the original application. I think the issue was when it went from a glass, somehow when it went from a glass roof to a tile roof, somehow it got labeled different in terms of the understanding of, and it wasn't until the complaint was filed in 2000 whatever, that somebody said, well, maybe so. Maybe the tile roof makes a difference.
Okay, thank you.
All right,
thank you.
Thank you.
I would actually like... go ahead.
I want to close the public hearing.
I would actually like county staff to respond to that last question on page 239. I mean, I don't read plans as a professional for a living, so does county staff see that the patio is indicated up to the... property line? Do you read that?
Oh, I don't think the question
Let staff answer the question here.
But I think it is the patio and the enclosed walls and all the rest of it that went with it shown on the plot plan.
Okay, let staff answer her question.
Okay, from the plot plan, looking at 239, it appears that the dark... Here, let me put this up here. The
make it bigger. Thank you.
Okay, the arrow here is identifying the top floor of the structure. This area here,
the dashed line
is showing the existing lower area of the structure, and I cannot tell from this plot plan that there. It appears that what was built is in 90 after 97, somewhere between 97 and 87 and 80 and 89. That the patio enclosure, the surrounding fence, so to speak, was built here at the property lines, where I'm going around. And then subsequently enclosed all this area, because right now this dashed line is the new 1997 upper story approved patio enclosure that is shown on 243.
This is the original.
All right. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to add to that. Warren just handed me the original out of the file that's a little more legible, and the dashed line and the arrows that go to the dashed line, maybe I'm not the only one that can't read that, but it says deck above are the words that actually
right.
go to those.
I see those.
And then down below it says patio, concrete patio. So on the original approved building permit from 1987, we approved a concrete patio outside of the lower floor.
And there are gates at the point where the structure tapers toward deck above. There's gates on either side that suggest access back
correct
through there.
That's why it looks so funny. That's obviously the glass.
So when this back enclosure was built in 87 and inspected and marked off, this existed?
No. Well, let me just check one thing here. See, this is the 87, and it looks like it meets the setbacks in 87, according to this view. And then here, it looks like it extends
right.
out.
Right.
It looks like it, but I'm not sure of that. I can't.
The reason that I agree with staff on that is in the earlier picture, it has kind of a convex contour to it, which tracks the...
Yeah, go back and forth a couple of times.
Yeah.
Marcia, you can just hit the up arrow on the keyboard to go back faster.
And the convex shape corresponds to what we see on the approved plans. It kind of, you know, arcs around the front.
Down here.
And that clearly is a straight wall there, built apparently to the property line.
Yeah, very good point. Very good point. Yeah. That to me is fundamental. Any other discussion?
The other point that I would raise is reading the CZLUO, I believe there are five findings that this commission has to make in order to grant a variance. I can't list them off. I know some of them are paraphrased in the findings for denial, but one of the findings we have to have to make in order to grant a variance is that the construction that's pursuant to the variance is not injurious to the health and safety. Is that one of the findings we need to make?
I believe so, and I believe that the court in the La Mesa case found that having it at 7 feet instead of 10 feet, that there was would not be any harm to anyone.
Right.
So it's
so forth. So
looking at the same issue,
and it would seem to me that we ought to have a finding to say that we, at least I think, that granting the variance would in fact
there is in that's the finding E.
E.
On 2.5,
all right,
will adversely affect health and safety.
You're right. Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Ready?
I am.
All right. I'll move to deny the request of variance coastal development permit by Frank Parnell, DRC 2004-00224, based on the findings listed in Exhibit A.
Second.
Discussion? Roll call?
Commissioner Melskow?
Yes.
Commissioner Christie?
Yes.
Commissioner Gibson?
Yes.
Commissioner Rappa?
No.
Chairman Rose?
Yes. And I find the, for me, those pictures that I'm glad Ms. Christie observed that critical difference, and that to me said everything. Okay, can we move on to the three little pigs? Introduce the next step.
You had to say it, didn't you, Bob?
Matt, you gotta help me if you
can. Introduce our next item, please.
Hearing to consider an appeal by Jim and Julie McDougall of a planning director determination that pot-bellied pigs are similar to hogs and swine and are subject to the ordinance standards for the keeping of these animals. The site is in the San Luis Bay planning area, county file number 9, Supervisorial District 4, Nancy Orton, project manager.
I have to pull up my presentation. We actually have the applicant's presentation up. And so I need to get to G Drive. Okay. Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Nancy Orton with the County Planning Department. The item before us here this morning is an appeal by Jim and Julie McDougall of a planning director determination, which basically relates to pot-bellied pigs being similar to hogs and swine and subject to ordinance standards for the keeping of those animals. Excuse me? No? I want to be under PowerPoint presentation. Can you turn the volume up, please? as household pets. Based on other jurisdictions considering them to be pets, the fact that they're sold in pet shops, the fact that they're considered to be comfort household animals, and they're not used as a food source for human consumption. After research and discussion, the department made the call that they fall in the swine family. They are genealogically related to the swine family, and we have standards in our ordinance that relate to hogs and swine. The applicant has appealed that planning director's determination, and that's why we're here today. The existing setting, which I will show an aerial photo and pictures of the property in a moment, the existing setting is a 12,000-square-foot lot in the community of Oceano. It is located in residential single-family zoning. It is at the end of a private easement road called Peacock Place. The applicants have approximately 10 household pets on the property, 4 pot-bellied pigs, 4 dogs, and several cats. The staff report on page 3-3 discusses the county land use ordinance as it relates to animal keeping. The purpose of the animal keeping section is intended to minimize potential adverse effects on adjoining property, the neighborhood, and persons in the vicinity from the improper management of animals. There are special standards that relate to hogs and swine. Essentially, hogs and swine are not allowed in residential single-family zoning on small lots. You need a minimum of 2.5 acres for hogs and swine, according to our land use ordinance. The land use ordinance also talks about household pets and basically allows up to 3 household pets on a property. And it does allow household pets other than dogs and cats.
So up to 3?
Up to 3. Yes, that's correct. Now I will show some aerial photos and some pictures of the property.
And while you're making your computer work there, I must disclose I visited the site and discussed the situation with the applicants. Okay. Touched the pigs.
Did you kiss the pigs, Bob?
No, I did not kiss the pigs.
Okay. This is the property is approximately right here. Off of Christmas Tree Place and Peacock. This is an aerial photo showing the site. In the highlighted area, this is the house, and then these are the surrounding. This is the surrounding area. This parcel right here was recently subdivided into 5 parcels of between 6,000 and 7,000-square-foot lots.
And I would add that that house that's shown at the top is no longer there. Only the foundation is there.
That's correct. That was removed for potentially a future house when that gets subdivided. Okay. This is a picture of the pigs, providing a human scale. People have different impressions of are they big, are they small. These are 3 of them next to the owner. This is a picture showing their house, their little house in the background, and then this is the neighboring house on the other side of the fence. Same view further away. There they are in front of the house. This is the property line between the 2 homes. Their house, neighboring house. This is looking down. It's in a little bit of a swale, but this is the McDougal's house and their garage and yard. This is the property. This is the property line of the adjoining vacant lot, the one that could be a future subdivision. That's the property to the east. And there's another picture of the pot-bellied pigs in the yard. They told me that the dogs were not there. They were in the garage because they just wanted me to be focusing on meeting the pigs.
And how many dogs were there?
Four.
Okay.
But I did see them. They were in the backyard with the older pig.
And there was an enforcement action that you referenced. What's the status of that?
That is an open enforcement case.
Pending a determination?
Pending what the outcome of this process is, yes. The summary, I just wanted to do a summary of the issues. Basically, is a pot-bellied pig a household pet or a hog, swine, farm animal? And if it's a household pet, the next issue that the McDougals will be facing is that there's a maximum of three allowed unless a conditional use permit is approved that would waive those particular standards in the land use ordinance.
And is that a maximum of three animals or a maximum of three animals of each species?
No, it's a maximum of three household pets.
Total.
Yes, three total. Staff's recommendation is to deny the appeal based on the findings listed in Exhibit A of the staff report, and that concludes my presentation.
Gene?
Yes, so one more question. We're looking at four pot-bellied pigs, four dogs, yes. And do you include the cats?
We include the cats.
All right, so we're talking 10 animals.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
That's all I have right now.
Okay.
Other commissioner questions before we open to public comment? I had one. Let's go to a land use category where pigs would be allowed, such as residential or rural. And I saw the houses look kind of close to the property line. Are there restrictions in those land use categories that would preclude that? Because that just seemed like a good idea to have the houses right next to the property line.
There is a setback requirement.
What would that be?
In the hog and swine section of the ordinance, which basically says animal enclosures shall be located no closer than 100 feet from any dwelling other than those on the site. So 100 feet away from other dwellings.
But you could have them right next to your house, but 100 feet from the neighbor's
house.
Yeah,
you can have your house wherever you want.
I had one more question. There's a letter we have in our in front of us from the Sheriff's Department, 2004, Animal Services Division, indicating they consider pot-bellied pigs to be exotic pets. Is the term exotic pet show up anywhere in the land use ordinance as opposed to household pet, as opposed to livestock?
We do have a section on exotic animals.
While Nancy's looking that up, Kim Murray, planning and building staff, to follow up on your question, Chairman Roos, the setbacks in other categories are typically kicked in when a property is an acre or more in size. So typically on residential, rural, or suburban properties, you're going to be an acre of property, and your setbacks for other houses are also larger. It's required to be 30 feet.
So evidently, pigs are not allowed in residential single family. I know they are in residential rural. How about residential suburban?
I believe they are if you have 2.5 acres.
Okay, so then you could meet that 100-foot right. thing then. Gene, I see you have another question.
Yeah, you say an acre. An acre is 210 by 210. You've got to keep them right in the center of that acre then to stay 100 feet away.
No, because the other house would have at least a 30-foot setback.
You're talking from the property line or the dwelling?
Well, the setback is for the animals is from adjacent houses.
Oh, okay.
The setback from the house is from
okay.
the property line.
All right, so they'll get a little bigger pen.
Correct.
Or a little bit to one side.
Unless you had a skinny lot.
Yeah.
Then you have to have skinny pigs.
Yeah.
Okay, Ms. Horton?
In answer to your question about the exotic animals, we have a section called zoo animals, and it does mention the keeping of a particular exotic animal may be allowed subject to specific provisions in subsections H2 through H11. And so,
we can come back to that.
Well, you're actually onto something there because I also must disclose I was a 4-H swine leader, and I was also a docent at the Atascadero Zoo, and among my duties was taking care of their pot-bellied pig.
Oh, I think that constitutes a conflict of interest, Chairman Rose.
I could give you a funny story about the day we castrated the thing. but we're not going there.
Actually, this just basically takes you back to all the different animals do require a 1-acre minimum site area.
Okay, any other questions for staff before I'm open up to the public?
Zoo animals, is that a subset of exotics, or are those terms equivalent?
Here they're being used somewhat equivalently.
Okay. Somewhat. Okay, I'll open up the public hearing. I have several speaker slips, including the applicant. Everyone else has 3 minutes since the applicant had to pay good money. They get longer than that. Julie McDougall. Doesn't look like Julie to me. We're going to do a team presentation here.
Well, he's actually the one that's prepared
that. I have a PowerPoint presentation.
Okay. Okay.
And will I have...
You got to get on a microphone, and you got to say who you are. And you're not Julie.
Good morning. Jim McDougall. I'm in front of you here today to fight for our right to keep our pot-bellied pigs as pets. And I have a PowerPoint presentation that I'd like to go through here.
Ramona.
There.
And this PowerPoint presentation, I need the ability to click through it. Can I do that somehow?
Well, you can tell her. Well, we got a little microphone there.
Okay.
You can tell.
I can just say click and
yep.
She'll do it.
Click. So my presentation this morning is are pot-belly pigs actually household pets, or are they farm hogs? Click. Click. I'd like to start out with the history of pot-belly pigs. They originally came from Vietnam, Eurasia area. Click. And they've been bred for centuries as pets. Click. They're bred for size, disposition, color, and conformity, much as dogs and cats. Click. They originally came to U.S. 20 years ago as household pets, click, and initially cost thousands of dollars. They were initially kind of a fad pet and have tapered off as to regular pet owners that have looked into the animal and really cherished them as pets, click. There's many clubs, breeders, and owners across the country that use pot-belly pigs as companion pets and treat them like family members. Click. Some differences, as Ms. Orton mentioned, genealogically, if you look at the canine group, excuse me, you have dogs and wolves, which are in the same species but quite different. I don't think many people are going to keep wolves in their houses. Click. A little more extreme case are cats and lions. Again, felines, but quite different. Click. And as well as pot-belly pigs and farm hogs and swine, pot-belly pigs are a much smaller, distant cousin of the farm hog and swine. Pot-belly pigs are about one-tenth the size, so you need to consider that when you're talking about impacts on properties and things like that. Click. Click. Description of a pot-belly pig, they average in weight about 110, 150 pounds. Click. Their average height is about 20 inches. And these are something some features that you can use to regulate potbelly pigs so you don't introduce hog farms and swines into an ordinance or into a residential area. You can govern potbelly pigs by their weight or by their height or both. Their disposition is intelligent, curious, docile. Click. Potbelly pigs, we feed them potbelly pig pellets that we buy at the pet store. They're mainly alfalfa and some other nutrients. And then we get some vegetables at the vegetable stand for them. Click. Their lifespan is generally between 8 and 13 years. There was mention of our pig in the backyard. We believe she's about 10, 11 years old. We rescued her when she was an older pig. Click. Starting out our pig adventure, we did research on potbelly pigs to find out if they were, in fact, a pet that we'd like. So we researched the internet and spoke to people, visited a pig sanctuary, down in Solvang, and found them to be, you know, something that we'd like to get involved with. So our first step in the process is to find out if potbelly pigs are, in fact, allowed in Oceano. So Looker's potbelly pig, we investigated with Animal Services again to find out if potbelly pigs were allowed in Oceano. And we were, in fact, told that, yes, potbelly pigs were considered pets, and they were allowed. I'm a mechanical engineer, so by nature I'm very thorough about things, and I wanted to make absolutely sure that we were safe having these pets and we wouldn't run into any kind of hassle like this. But here we are. Click. December 2002, we rescued Abigail Sue, which is our pig in our backyard. She's more of a older sedentary pig, and, you know, we love her to pieces, but Julie wanted more of a companion pig, one that would follow her around, come in the house, you know, watch TV with her, and she could give belly rubs too. And so we looked into adopting another pig. Click. So in September of 2003, again, I called Animal Services. I wanted to be absolutely certain that potbelly pigs were allowed in our area. And again, we were told there were no restrictions. Potbelly pigs are pets. Click. So in September 2003, we rescued a pregnant potbelly pig from the sanctuary, and she soon had her babies. Click. And click. And then we fell in love with the babies, and the neighbors were involved with the babies too. They'd feed the babies, and, you know, they'd come see them. And one of the neighbors, Mrs. Shepherd, took down her fence so they could go graze in her yard. And so, you know, the neighbors were pretty responsive to the pets. You know, we had no adverse reactions with them. So we decided we'd like to keep two of the piglets. Click. So as a final interaction with Animal Services, I spoke to them once again. I wanted to make sure that four dogs, two cats, and four potbelly pigs were allowed in Oceano. Again, I was told no restrictions on numbers or potbelly pigs. I was absolutely thorough in finding out if we were allowed these pets. And apparently, I was given false information, or I'm not quite understanding where the whole deal is here. You know, we can't get rid of our pets. Click. Click. So the process, we lived happily for a year and a half after the piglets were born. Click. Until we came home one day and I found a business card on my front gate saying that there was a complaint, and could I please contact Ms. Gamaro from code enforcement. So I called her, and she said that there was a complaint that we were putting in a garage without a permit. And I told her what was happening. I moved some dirt. First I checked with planning to make sure that I didn't need a permit, and no, I did not. So I moved some dirt so I could put my garage in. And she said, okay, you know, I'll accept that. And she said, there's also a complaint that came in at the same time about you having pigs on the property. And she was saying that you can't have pigs in a residential area. And I told her that I had checked with Animal Services to find out if I could have these potbelly pigs, and they, in fact, said yes. So she said that she'd check into it and get back with me. So a few days later, she got back with me and said she did check into it, and yes, they are considered hogs and swine, and you need 2.5 acres. So with that, So I requested a formal planning director's interpretation. In June, I received the interpretation, and the interpretation basically said that potbelly pigs are, in fact, going to be treated as hogs and swine, and that we needed to get rid of them. To us, that wasn't acceptable, and we were going to fight it. So, Specifically in this letter from Ms. Orton, she addressed nuisance factors, waste, smell, vectors, soil compaction, noise, etc., and that potbelly pigs are considered livestock, and that we needed to get rid of them. So it seems that the main topic of these complaints were two Ms. Orton may be able to attest to, or not, because they both had site visits. But we find these two factors of complaint unfounded. Something that came out in Ms. Orton's report was that the County Environmental Health Department made a site visit. And in the report it says, Environmental Health said, although there were some feces at the time of the visit, neither that nor the flies were enough to warrant the Health Department taking any action. So here's a governmental agency that is saying
You got to kind of speed it up here. You're well past 20 minutes here. Keep talking.
So addressing other nuisance factors, noise shouldn't be a problem. Soil compaction, they're no more than dogs. They weigh about the same as medium to heavier dogs. Their waste is tight, compact, and easy to dispose of. A letter inside your packets there is from our veterinarian, Dr. Hennessy, and she specifically addresses vectors, although she wasn't very clear on what planning was saying about vectors, but she specifically addresses flies, mosquitoes, and so on, and says none of them are a problem. Soil compaction, again, not a problem. And she says, as far as her colleagues, as far as vets are concerned, they are not considered livestock, which hogs and swine are in the ordinances under livestock.
Mr. McDougall, I believe a lot of these letters are in our packet, and you can assume that the commissioners have read them.
Thank you. That speeds things up.
Thanks.
She also addresses in there that, you know, is this complaints or is this harassment, which is a valid point. You can click through all these. These are just family pictures. It goes on for a while.
Peacocks aren't ours.
We live in an area where there's a colony of about 60 peacocks that live around us, which the neighbors may be complaining about next. Who knows? This shows the relative size of a potbelly pig next to our basset hound. Click. Here's Otis going out to his bed. Here's where they sleep. Click. Here's them sleeping in their house, which does not smell. Here's our property. They're enclosed. Click. Back behind this fence in that area over there. Here's a bunch of peacocks on our back fence there. Click. Another peacock. Recently, the Tribune ran an article on our potbelly pigs, and this is a poll that came out of that. 75% in favor of allowing potbelly pigs in neighborhoods. Click. Potbelly pigs are found out throughout the internet as pets. Click. 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 So specifically addressing the code and ordinances, potbelly pigs are recognized throughout the country as pets. Click. There's at least 55 counties and cities in California alone that I know of that do allow potbelly pigs as pets. Sacramento, Los Angeles, and in our own county, Paso Robles and Arroyo Grande. Click. Click. Paso Robles classifies potbelly pigs as miniature animals. Click. And in their ordinances, they allow dogs and miniature animals, maximum number of 3 per household. Click. Click. Arroyo Grande lists them as household pets. Click. And animal keeping provisions allow them as pets. Click. Click. Slo County ordinances refers to other kindred animals usually and ordinarily kept as household pets. Click. And livestock means horses, ponies, mules, and swine is included there. Click. So potbelly pigs, click, are solely kept as household pets. Click. Potbelly pigs are not used as a food source. Advertises that they are the responsible party. Click. And Animal Services, as this letter from Dr. Anderson, Animal Services Manager, states, are considered pets. Exotic pets, but pets. Click. County Planning is trying to override Animal Services in this matter. Click. And we have proved to be responsible, conscientious pet owners. The neighbors themselves claim that we do pick up after them every day. And we do keep our property clean. We keep the dogs quiet. We keep we don't interfere in anybody's lives. And we don't understand where this is coming from. Click. The nuisance factors are minimal. Click. So now we have 4 dogs, 2 cats, and 4 potbelly pigs that we thought we had every right to have, because we checked with the proper defining agency. So where are we at now? Click. Click. So that's where we're at this point. And after hearing from other parties here, I'd like to make ending comments.
You'll be able to make a brief rebuttal remarks.
Yeah, brief is fine.
I see any questions for... I see everybody looking at their watches. We're well past our noon hour, so I know at least a couple of commissioners have appointments for lunch.
I did have one question of staff. Could we see, since we are going to break over the noon hour, if we could contact Animal Services and hopefully Dr. Anderson might be available for comments? Would that be possible? Or a representative?
Okay, and with that, we'll break for lunch. We'll come back here at 1:30.
Okay.